are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, March 28th, 2019. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. Joining us on today's program, Daniel Bessner, professor of international relations at the University of Washington, talking about his new piece in The Nation magazine, Foreign Policy Beyond Good and Evil, co-authored with Udi Greenberg, talking about charting a left humanitarian, but also real-world-based foreign policy approach. A disaster relief bill hits a snag in the Senate. Democrats are pushing for greater assistance to Puerto Rico. Trump says they're already getting too much as food stamp hit the colonized island of Puerto Rico. Donald Trump has signed off on selling nuke technology to the Saudis in a major escalation of global security. A judge strikes down Medicaid work requirements in Arkansas and Kentucky. Good news for people there. What will be the counterattack? DOJ charges 18 members of a white supremacist prison gang as more and more information emerges on the Identity Europa fascist gang. The NRA official sought Sandy Hook hoaxer to question Parkland shooting emails show the nexus between the weapons cartel lobby and the conspiracy industry shown there. Theresa May tells MPs that she will be out after the UK is out of the European Union, but the UK crisis, austerity and Brexit continues to deepen.
You seem to be a bit of a glum bucket.
She does seem to be a bit of a glum bucket. Actually, absolutely terrible and xenophobic, but I think we're going to have to give her fairly resilient. The Mitch McConnell, for some reason, keeps blocking the full Mueller report, which will obviously look totally great for Donald Trump and be totally awesome. Wonder why he wouldn't help his friend out more by letting everybody see the full exoneration. Majorities, incidentally, from both parties across all political lines want to see our report. Fact was, literally used with our tax dollars on our behalf.
Yeah, the Republicans want to see it for different reasons.
Republicans want, right. Mike Pompeo is now backing out of even mouthing U.S. support for a two-state solution as Bibi escalates a neo-fascist authoritarian run for re-election in Israel, and Israel pummels Gaza, killing more Israeli civilians. President Maduro argues that it was a sniper rifle that took out Venezuela's hydroelectric dam. 187 Republicans vote against a bill to close the gender pay gap. And over 400 jurists and lawyers in Brazil sign a letter condemning the imprisonment of President Lula on baseless, corrupted, ridiculous charges. And President Bolsonaro sinks to record low approval ratings, even as other machinations are afoot. All that and more on today's Majority Report. Well, everybody, as we said there, there's an election going on in Israel. And I should say it's Boys Thursday.
For the boys.
For the boys. Saturdays for working. I like how Trump's that is a funny like part of Trump's self concept, that he's constantly working and he's like never worked a day in his life, but his sense of work is like, you yell at underlings, you have ridiculous phone calls, you golf, and then TV asks me about my arguments with other people on TV. There's an election campaign going on in Israel. And you can listen back a couple weeks ago with Juan Cole. There are actual disagreements inside Israeli politics on, as an example, spending, on deregulation. Israel, like everywhere else in the world, has gone through a sort of market deregulation, privatization process, oligarch wealth concentration process of the past couple of decades that have hurt their social safety net, massively increased inequality, increased poverty, diminished job prospects, and also added to a much broader atmosphere of serious corruption and systemic corruption in Israel. Israel has a huge amount of corruption problems. The indictments against Bibi are not just about garden variety corruption, though. That's part of it. But it's also the leveraging of a free newspaper that was just funded and distributed freely by Sheldon Adelson, the American far-right casino magnate and, you know, with a very, 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 very extreme views on Israel. And Netanyahu using that as a base to essentially try to extort press coverage, right? So these charges are also about a broader unwinding of, even inside 67 borders, Israel's institutions. No candidates that are in the race as of now with any serious chance of wielding power will do anything about the fact that Israel is an apartheid state, the fact that they control 5 million other human beings, the fact that there's rampant civilian abuses and killings, the fact that there's two different sets of laws in places like the West Bank. And the reality is politically that besides an occasional rocket attack, which of course should go without saying, but I feel like we do need to say it, of course we condemn, Israel is very secure. And there's no political price to be paid for this. And the modern consensus in Israel is really, I mean, there's some arguments about nation branding. And someone like Ehud Olmert will come out and still make noises about a two-state solution. But there's a huge amount of racism. There's a very right-wing political consensus, and there's a comfort in that situation. The joint list of Arab and socialist parties, as of a couple weeks ago, were not allowed to run, even as a Kahanist, which can literally be called at least actual Jewish terrorist adjacent political party, is running in a broader right effort. So democracy in Israel is in bad shape. And the rights and justice for the Palestinian people remain at the bottom of the list of any kind of broader project. And you saw that in all of the racism and conspiracy theorizing and bloodlust at AIPAC. But this really drives the point home. This is an ad that is running in Israel right now. Everybody knows that Netanyahu and Trump are incredibly close. I would argue that they share a broader tendencies of the global far right. But there's also all sorts of specific synergies between people like Adelson, the Christian Zionist community, and Trump gave Bibi the Golan over a tweet, formalized an occupation, has supported, you know, every step of the way, killing civilians protesting in Gaza, Jerusalem's the capital, all the other things that we know, and also torturing just generally. You know, pulling even basic funding from Palestinian institutions. Bibi is running on the race card again, just as he did in the last election when he did an emergency video warning people that Arabs were coming out to vote. Here is an ad. This is basically an excerpt from a Frontline documentary which shows Bibi just disrespecting President Obama to his face in the White House. And then there's reactions. It's clearly a Frontline documentary. So you have the clip, and then it's interspersed with journalists. And I think Ben Rhodes, who was obviously Obama's foreign policy, one of his foreign policy guys, basically just talking about how angry everybody in the White House was and how just sort of shockingly disrespectful this display was on a protocol level. And the spin here, the twist, I should say, this is a campaign ad that Benjamin Netanyahu is running in Israel. So as he hugs Trump, the white supremacy president, he's literally running an ad which is just designed purely to showcase that I personally and directly disrespected America's first African-American president. And this is, by the way, Beebe's also was a prime minister during Clinton's presidency. So there's, and there were conflicts with Clinton. In fact, Clinton sent his campaign strategist to advise Ehud Barak, or maybe not personally, but clearly Clinton wanted Netanyahu out. There is no equivalent of this kind of disrespect towards Bill Clinton, let alone, of course, the relationship he has with Netanyahu. Watch this. This is an ad running right now in Israel.
But this time, Bibi Netanyahu would lecture Barack Obama, taking a hard line on the peace process.
It's not going to happen. Everybody knows it's not going to happen. And I think it's time to tell the Palestinians forthrightly, it's not going to happen.
I've never seen a foreign leader speak to the president like that, and certainly not in public. And I've certainly never seen it happen in the Oval Office.
Israel obviously cannot be asked to negotiate with a government that is backed by the Palestinian version of Al-Qaeda.
You're watching President Obama there with his face in his hand, and you can tell it's not going over well. This is his house, and to be lectured in his office rankles.
It cannot go back to the 1967 lines, because these lines are indefensible.
Bill Daley standing next to me, and he's going, outrageous, outrageous.
Netanyahu, Yamin.
And that is Netanyahu telling Barack Obama that even this process of a two states and 67 borders, which is already stunning, like for the Palestinians to accept that, they would have to accept, you know, it's a given that hundreds of thousands of us were displaced. It's a given that we're not necessarily going to get financial restitution. And all of the two-state solutions that were put on the table still were not sort of fully autonomous for the Palestinians. All sorts of questions about waterways and air travel and airspace. So that was Netanyahu just basically saying to Obama, like, hey, listen, get it. We're going to be an apartheid state. And even if I have to fake with you some type of pseudo two-state solution, which he still mouthed, it won't be a real one. This happened, and I look, you can see Obama's rage, and by 2017, the Obama administration was at least ready to abstain on a resolution condemning settlement expansion. And that actually, of course, leads to the story of real, and look, I don't want to say real because I don't want to get into this argument, but an actual case of collusion that we do know about and has been on the public record from 2017, which is Michael Flynn during the transition connecting to Russia, presumably others, at the behest of the Israelis to try to undermine Obama's policy of simply abstaining, not even voting for the resolution, but abstaining, which was significant. But now we have a whole other level of courage about this thugocracy with Ilhan Omar. And Netanyahu at AIPAC personally addressed her. And, you know, again, this is in a context, obviously, with just a massive amount of racism and sexism and paranoia and bigotry and fear about Muslims, which is the meeting ground of Netanyahu and AIPAC and Trump and all of that. That's the nexus. It's certainly, I mean, if you think it's concerned about anti-Semitism, then I would, you know, I would like to take some time to figure out an internet scam I can list you in if I ever get time. This is what Netanyahu said to Ilhan Omar. And of course, he's referencing her "It's All About the Benjamins Baby" tweet of a couple weeks ago that people made a whole ridiculous melodrama about. From this Benjamin, it's not about the Benjamins. Undoubtedly, maybe a line written by his stupid son. And this led to Ilhan Omar, Yaz Queen. Dude, I am legitimately aggrieved that I will not be able to vote for this woman for president one day. She continues to impress and impress and impress. The sort of, what would you call this emoji? This is like the kind of thinking face, sarcastic thinking face
scratching
emoji.
Scratching chin.
Scratching chin emoji, which I actually have used some decent effect myself. Not a big emoji guy, but I like this one. This one does a lot of work. She writes, This from a man facing indictments for bribery and other crimes in three separate public corruption affairs. Next. I don't have anything to add to that. Go contribute to her campaign.
Got it, finally.
Thank you. Go contribute to Ilhan Omar's campaign and make sure that any effort to undermine her, we beat back and destroy. We need her in Congress. We need her leadership. And we also need to protect her from the conspiracists and the hate mongers.
Yeah.
That's definitely profoundly important. So, as always, props to her.
Yeah, her and her staff need to know that people got their back.
100%. And again, I'll be transparent. I've given two different $27 donations to Bernie. That feels great. In my estimation, we simply need him to be, that's just the obvious choice. I think I'm very transparent about that. And a couple of weeks ago, at the height of this, I went to her committee and chipped in $27, and that felt incredibly rewarding. So if I would just editorialize, I'd recommend everybody else do the same. One of the most important things we can do for our health every day is brushing our teeth, yet most of us don't do it properly. Do you guys know this?
I do, but only because I'm familiar with this copy.
Indeed. Or this excellent product.
I am personally familiar with this product. I used it this morning.
I'm not familiar. Tell me more.
Thank you, Brendan. Those are both very helpful bridges. Quip is a better electric toothbrush created by dentists and designers. Quip, and I'm a regular Quip user myself, totally convinced it's best in terms of brushing and travel.
Travels well.
Definitely. Quip was designed to make brushing your teeth more simple, affordable, and even enjoyable. With sensitive sonic vibrations, it's gentle on your sensitive gums. And the built-in two-minute time pulses every 30 seconds to remind you when to switch sides and guide you to full and even clean. Because, your teeth are like a four quadrants. And what ideally, you want 30 seconds on each area of the distribution. Well, the Quip times it for you. And you don't have to deal with a clunky charger, which I love. That means it's easy to travel, so you can keep up your great brushing routine when you're on the road. And it runs for 3 months on one charge. I love this toothbrush. I have certainly never in my life, and I don't think that this would surprise anybody, I'm not a product recommendation guy. I'm not somebody who finds a new cooking salt or something. You know, even if I do, it just doesn't occur to me. I'm not someone who shouts. I recommend books to people.
Yeah, you're not the gadget guy.
I'm not the gadget guy at all. I have recommended and purchased as a gift Quip for at least a couple of people in my life. It's an incredible, incredible convenience. That's why I love it. And that's why they're backed by over 20,000 dental professionals. Quip starts at $25. And if you go to Quip, and if you go to getquip.com/majority right now, you get your first refill pack for free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/majority. Getquip.com/majority. We're going to take a brief break. We'll be right back with Daniel Bessner. Welcome back to the Majority Report. Joining us now is Daniel Bessner. He's the Pyle Professor of American Foreign Policy at the University of Washington. He's the author of Hans Speier and the Rise of the Defense Intellectuals. He's also a regular, I must say, on the Michael Brooks Show. Daniel Bessner, thanks so much for joining the Majority Report. How are you doing?
Thanks for having me, Michael. Good, man. I'm doing good.
It's always a pleasure. So you took first, why would you name a foreign policy piece after Nietzsche? That's like peak Bessner.
Basically, as you know, and probably many listeners do, authors don't actually come up with the names of these pieces, but it's the Nation's editors did. But I think it works pretty well. I mean, the basic claim being that we really need to stop thinking of foreign policy in these very stark dualistic or what might be termed Manichaean terms of good, of we're good and other people are evil, even if, of course, other people are, in fact, evil. It's not a useful way to think about what the United States should do in the world.
So you specifically, actually, you and your co-author, I should say, Udi Greenberg, lay out a pretty, you've got some pretty tough, you took the two, the progressive candidates, you took Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. And you laid out actually some pretty hard critiques of them. We'll get to that in a second, but can you, before we do that, go to your kind of intellectual history roots? How did this notion, because it isn't just the neocons and Iraq, and it isn't just the new reporting on the sort of like Christian Armageddon agenda through Trump and Pompeo, I should say. There's a history at least going back, I would assume, to the defense intellectuals that you chronicle after World War II of this Manichaean worldview of American foreign policy. How did that develop, and how does that connect with, the reality of American foreign policy as a militaristic transactional empire?
Sure. I mean, it's a great question. And to begin, one really has to recognize that for a long time, at least probably 6,000 to 7,000 years, anthropologists have discovered that societies have been defining themselves against an outside other. Mm-hmm. Right. There's us, the community, and there's an other, and we are against them. So this is a very deep thing in human society and human civilization. But to bring it back up to a recent period, I think beginning it really in the 1930s, when the United States and the North Atlantic countries, the UK and France in particular, began to confront Nazi Germany, what I would characterize as a truly evil state, like a state that was truly evil in its goals and in its leadership in particular, of course, the countries of the North Atlantic began to define themselves against this other, this evil other, democracy versus fascism. And this became a rallying cry before World War II, when FDR was trying to get the nation to fight World War II, and then during the war itself. But then what happened, I think, is that after the war, this governing logic, this idea that the United States is good and its enemies are evil, began to be pushed from Nazi Germany and onto the Soviet Union. And of course, this is not to apologize for Stalin's many crimes, but I do think that the character of the Soviet regime, especially as we open up their archives and learn more and more about the decision-making process of the Soviet Union, it just wasn't the state that was as bent on destruction and domination as Nazi Germany we know was in fact bent on. Like, if you go to the Soviet archives, you could see how Stalin, kind of wanted to make peace after World War II and didn't necessarily want to fight a Cold War with the United States. And really, after Stalin's death, when Khrushchev took over, Nikita Khrushchev, he was certainly ready to make peace with the Soviet Union. But the reason that this didn't happen, I think, is that the United States began to view, during and after World War II, they began to view international politics as a realm of struggle between good and evil, where the United States was good and democratic and was spreading liberty and, of course, capitalism around the world. And the Soviet Union was its total mirror image opposite, other communist, totalitarian, and bent on world domination. And of course, I think a lot of that view had a really important role in legitimating a lot of actions that American leaders themselves understood to be anti-democratic. So, for example, the 1953 overthrow of Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran, which is very critical to understanding why Iranians hate the United States, the 1954 overthrow of Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala, the American support for the East German uprising in December of 1953. A lot of these actions, which were understood to be anti-democratic, were legitimated because the United States considered itself to be in a basically global existential struggle with the Soviet Union.
That's a really, and so just, and I want to just actually elaborate a little bit more, and I'm thinking of this now, so I don't remember this person's name, unfortunately, but I was at some event once where, you know, one of the speakers was basically some type of, you know, some type of kind of like young and up-and-coming neocon, and what he was doing was trying to propagandize against Obama's Iran deal at the time, and it was incredible because, you know, most of the arguments against the Iran deal were not most, but a lot of them were, some of them were very technical, and you either could just dispel them technically, like, no, first of all, there's a lot of hype around Iran's program to begin with. We don't actually know what it is. And secondly, there is ways of monitoring and measuring it, or bringing in like ancillary issues. Like, well, you know, in fact, if you want to deal with long range ballistic missiles or Hezbollah, actually establishing this deal could open a roadmap maybe to further diplomacy, whatever. But this guy's argument, I think, circles back to what you're saying, where he basically said, well, we know, you know, Iran, and he had some, you know, some examples, which were true of the Iranian government, you know, seriously abusing people. And he basically just said, well, if they treat their people like that internally, then we know they're untrustworthy externally. And, you know, of course, the basic, you know, one response, which has some merit, is like, whoa, okay, you want to talk about how we treat people internally. Let's talk about, you know, I don't know, any policing in the United States. Mass incarceration, yeah. Right? But then the second point was actually like, that is ludicrous. And I think going back to the Stalin example, that's actually very good, right? Like, a lot, his crimes and his intention was to continue to go on to, you know, run an increasingly, you know, horrifying and totalistic and murderous police state to consolidate power in the Soviet Union, and actually to keep on the sort of communist path, which is another kind of part of the interest of the scholarship, where it's like, well, actually, there was some genuine commitment there too, which is interesting and disturbing, actually. But his foreign policy was very, like, you know, was actually pretty cautious and conservative, and he had already sort of climbed down from, clearly, but it's when he made the initial peace pact with Hitler, the idea that this is going to be some global revolutionary force was already climbed down on. And even, you know, one more thing to put in, one of the speculations around things like the Cultural Revolution is that in addition to consolidating Mao's power, it's the corollary of realizing that China isn't going to be as aggressive and as, you know, in fomenting revolution. So there needs to be like internal disruption and recreation of that fervor. So it seems like that idea that we can correlate internal abuse with external behavior on things like an arms control treaty is really deep in like the American foreign policy psyche.
Absolutely. And I think it just highlights the difficulties of applying a particular type of morality to international affairs, because I think you and I know we agree, and I'm sure most people listening would agree that the Stalin regime in the 40s and the 50s, and really the beginning with the purges in the 30s and the Moscow trials in 36, 37, and Mao's Cultural Revolution are really terrible crimes against humanity in a real sense. They really, you know, betray every leftist principle that I think one should advocate in favor of. But at the same time, the fact that this happens doesn't mean that the United States should commit itself to a half a century long militaristic foreign policy where it's constantly intervening in other countries to avoid the specter of an expansive Soviet Union, or what people are trying to do today, an expansive People's Republic of China, right? Which is now, right, for the first time in its modern history, really truly expanding into the world, giving development aid to Africa, the Belt and Road Initiative, creating these basically what might be termed counter-hegemonic structures like the Asian Infrastructure Bank and its various development projects. But I think it's important to emphasize that the United States cannot for even though its citizens may deplore these various internal actions, doesn't necessarily mean that we have to fight these existential global struggles, because what I think happens in the long run is that the United States winds up intervening, like in the cases I just mentioned in Guatemala, Iran, one might also add Chile, and a variety of other small actions, or in places like Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya, when if you go back and actually read what people were saying in the run-up to these various wars, particularly Iraq, was that they were literally comparing Saddam Hussein to Hitler and Iraq to Nazi Germany, which is basically an absurd historical comparison, but it serves as this legitimating function for basically never-ending U.S. militarism and U.S. wars abroad. So this is why basically you have to have two ideas in your head. You have to, you know, criticize Stalin, criticize the People's Republic of China, while also being willing to say that we can't necessarily do anything about it. And that's really the tragedy of international relations. You could do certain things, work through international institutions, use diplomacy, et cetera. For example, I think you could use diplomacy to try to halt or at least alleviate the Chinese persecution of the Uyghurs in Xinjiang. But you can't really do much more than that, because the global effects of that, I think history have demonstrated, are really and truly terrible. So it's important, I think, going forward, and particularly for progressive candidates like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, and just to put my cards on the table, I'll support Bernie till my dying day. I think he's the only really legitimate candidate, and I very much support him. But what I was trying to do is try to, like, I think it's important for the American public to be discussed with, to be fed a language that doesn't basically set international politics as a struggle between good and evil, because it's far more complicated than that. And that dichotomous Manichaean vision has done so much damage in the past, and I fear it could do an enormous amount of damage in the future. But just to complicate it a bit, I think Bernie is really has publicly been a little bit of two minds of this. So he does, I think, construct this dichotomous vision between a global authoritarian axis, and fair enough, there is a global authoritarian axis. But to frame that totally as evil and the United States is good is not necessarily the right thing to do. But Bernie also, I think, very correctly says that even if we disagree with what China is doing, we still need to deal with them to address climate change. We still need to deal with China to address global inequality. So Bernie, I think, is of two minds. And what I would do is just to emphasize the cooperative element, at least when you're talking about international relations, while also recognizing that the United States should do things at the UN or through various other global institutions to, for example, condemn the Chinese persecution of the Uyghurs.
I want to actually get really specifically to the problems and opportunities you see with Sanders and Warren. But I think there's one other thread I just want to put into this that I think is really important. There was a piece that came out several years ago by a guy named Paul Berman, who has had a lot of bad takes over the years. But it was a very interesting intellectual history of a guy named Yashka Fisher that I think Berman drew all of the wrong conclusions from. I mean, clearly he did, because I think he was at the time writing in favor of, you know, invading Iraq. So objectively he did. Yashka Fisher, to make a long story short, was a German, like an actual German radical, like a guy who, there's photos of him beating up a cop at a street protest.
He transferred arms too, yeah.
Transferred arms, was at a conference in the Middle East with, like, where the PLO was established. This was, I mean, you know, when you talk about the European 60s and 70s radicals, you know, it's like, sure, I guess there was some Weatherman people that blew themselves up or whatever. I mean, I don't want to minimize it. I know that some people got hurt and so on, but, like, there were actual groups in Europe, and I clearly, in many ways, was actually a very failed and politically destructive effort, but, like, you know, just to be real, they were actually doing some actual guerrilla activity. And Yashka Fisher wasn't quite there, but he was adjacent. Anyways, he would go on to help found the Green Party. And then by the time he came to public consciousness in the aughts, in the late 90s, he's Germany's foreign minister. And he's actually leading Germany into its first external military engagement since the Nazi era. So there's a lot of, like, wait, how does this, you know, hardcore left, anti-NATO, anti-Vietnam guy turn into a kind of like pan-European liberal who supports humanitarian intervention? And one of the threads, and this is where I want to get to you, one of the threads that Berman argues is that by in the early 80s, when Doctors Without Borders came around, the founders of Doctors Without Borders tapped into this idea that instead of these, like, grand ideological narratives, like getting rid of capitalism and so on, because they were coming from the left. They just want to go to places where people need help and help those people. And Berman was like, you know, this is the great post-ideological turn. And then disastrously, he basically kind of correlated that sentiment with, you know, the Bush administration waging an illegal war and, you know, killing tons of people and upending the Middle East, which is a disaster and nonsense. But I wonder if we actually stopped, you know, that thought process into the disaster of kind of like liberal humanitarian interventionism, which is a massive problem, but actually went back to the more modest version of it. So that, like, if we went looked at Syria, we realized, like, there might be diplomatic solutions that are really hard and really dissatisfying because it will involve any number of factions from Assad to rebels, and certainly Assad, I want to emphasize, who have an unbelievable amount of blood on their hands but still retaining some power, right? But then on the other hand, all of the conversation about to intervene or not to intervene and all of this actually distracted from some really core points that everybody on the left should have embraced, like massively higher investment in refugees and humanitarian resettlement. And areas like that, like, the whole globe has actually significantly dropped the ball on. And so when you talk about these other mechanisms, I mean, like, concretely, is it a way of saying, like, well, getting away from the disaster and military interventionism, what about, like, the U.S. commitment to full funding of, you know, the UN Refugee Agency or whatever else that actually deals with the literal human cost of all of these policies instead of, by the way, of course, making them worse with our own military presence?
That's absolutely right. And I think it's important to highlight, since Woodrow Wilson, at least, so let's say for about a century, and I think it actually goes back further, the great hope of liberalism in an international context is that it will be able to manage international affairs in the ways you exactly described, that you'll be able to do things like, for example, precision strikes and just get the quote unquote bad guys. And it's also to underline, like, it's kind of ridiculous that that's the language we use to talk about international politics, but bracket that for a second, or that you'll be able to use the military as some sort of precision force that could make the world safe for liberal humanitarian ideals. And I think that it's important for us to at least acknowledge the power of that claim, particularly before it proved to be false over and over and over again throughout the course of the 20th century. So I think what leftists could do and what leftist foreign policy thinking could bring to this entire discussion is to temper liberal dreams with historical realities. Mm-hmm. That even though, you know, in an ideal world, one would be able to, you know, stop the quote unquote bad guys and make the world safe for everyone, just history has shown that international politics just doesn't work that way. That the United States actually creates a lot more problems when it does things like militarily intervene in Libya, for example, or Iraq or Afghanistan, or the, you know, 149 countries our special forces were deployed in 2017. And that for this reason, you really have to temper those liberal dreams with what I would call historical realities. But this isn't necessarily to advocate a questioned posture, right? I think that the United States is being, you know, the center of world power, and it still very much is the center of world power. I do not think it is in absolute decline, even though it is in relative decline. The center of world power and having enormous amount of resources, I think the left could advocate a lot of clever solutions to global humanitarian crises, right? So let's say the United States is an enormously gigantic country. If anyone's ever driven through it, you see how much empty space there is. Why not actually resettle refugees here?
Right.
Why not use our massive resources to bring people who are being oppressed to the United States and actually contribute to the American fabric, as opposed to, you know, trying to bomb the people who are oppressing them? Right. Why not work with foreign governments to do things like that? Why not, like you said, to fund the United Nations, or to fund basically maybe even think about creating new institutions that could perhaps be more effective to help refugee resettlement? Now, of course, listen, I think we all agree no one likes being deracinated, moving from their own cultural context to another, but in a tragic world, a world in which there are only imperfect solutions, I think bringing people here is better than trying to use the military to save them. The only problem is that the reality, the desires of liberal internationalism come up against the realities of American domestic xenophobia and racism.
Right.
So you have these things that are fundamentally in tension, and the liberal answer has been to basically not incorporate people into our own polity, people who could actually only make it stronger if you're a cosmopolitan like I am, but instead to try to use what is fundamentally an illiberal tool. The military and war are illiberal tools. So what they have tried to do, and I think this is the paradox of liberalism, liberal internationalism over the past 100 years, is to use the most illiberal tool for liberal ends. And I think just history has shown time and again that this is impossible.
Absolutely. All right. So you touched on it before, but Sanders and Warren, what are they doing wrong? What are they doing right?
So the difficulty is that the United States public is used to hearing about foreign policy in a particular idiom and has been used to hearing it for 70 years, which is essentially framing the United States as quote unquote good and our challengers as quote unquote bad. So I think that it's important to just contextualize Sanders and Warren, who very much grew up in the era of the Cold War and hearing this political language over and over again, this moralistic and Manichaean language. I think it's important to contextualize them. So it's not just this to be unthinking criticism, but just to appreciate the context in which they arrived. But what I think that they have done is that in some way basically reframed the Manichaean division of international affairs that began with the U.S. and Nazis and then continued with the U.S. and Soviet Union, and one might add continued with the U.S. and radical Islam, quote unquote, right. Radical Islam. It's basically a nonsense term. It doesn't really mean anything, but basically for decades, the United States has organized its foreign policy thinking in dichotomous terms. And I think, so let's take what Bernie said. He basically constructed, I think, a division of the world between, you know, good democracies who actually care about liberty and what he called, I think it's, I forget the exact phrasing, but something like the global authoritarian kleptocratic axis consisting of like Russia. And sometimes he added China. And of course, Brazil, which I would agree with all of these things. I think these places are global kleptocratic states. But the question is that does that language actually basically push progressives to adopt an interventionist foreign policy that, as it has in the past, underrates diplomacy and promotes the type of violent interventions that I do think have more negative outcomes in the long term and medium term. And Warren is basically the same thing. And I think Warren's actually a little worse on this than Bernie, I guess, unsurprisingly, because she's a liberal in the way Bernie is not. But she claims that the very existence, or she has intimated at least in speeches, that the very existence of these types of kleptocratic pseudo-fascist states threaten and undermine American democracy, right? So if that's true, if these states, the very existence of these states necessarily undermines American democracy, then what can the solution be but try to overturn them or regime change, right? So right. This is the difficulty, because I think both Bernie and Warren are absolutely correct. Like, as you know, more better than most, Bolsonaro is a horrible fascist. Right. And he shouldn't be in power, and he's done a number of illegal actions, and he should absolutely not be in power. But the question is, if his very existence threatens democracy, particularly American democracy, does that mean that the United States should go in and overthrow him? The same could be said for Putin. The same could be said for Xi. And a lot of people are making the same claims about Maduro and Venezuela now. Right. Right? So it's a very, very complex and difficult situation. Right. Right. And right. So it's a very, very complex and difficult situation where they are correctly identifying these states as bad actors. But by framing them as necessarily engaged in a Manichaean struggle with the United States, I think that it has the potential, if it's not, you know, stopped or thought about in a different way, to go down the slippery slope towards some sort of interventionism. Whether it's military, it probably won't be, because I think Bernie has absolutely categorically rejected, as he should, military intervention. But even if it's something like sanctions, right? And as more and more research shows, sanctions actually have an enormously damaging effect on just normal people. For example, right. Normal people in Iran, right? So if you're going to impose sanctions against Brazil, that's ordinary Brazilians who are going to really suffer from those sanctions. So the question is, how are you able to identify these bad actors as truly bad, which they are? I would like to underline they are truly bad, without necessarily retreating into this dichotomous and moralistic understanding of world affairs. And it's a very, very difficult task, particularly when, as the United States, you have such an enormous amount of power that you can really do what you want in the world. But I think these are the sorts of difficult questions that we on the left need to be thinking through right now if we truly want to transform not only our domestic, but also our international affairs.
I think there's some complications in Bernie that I want to elaborate on, good and bad, in a second. But before that, I mean, what, you know, obviously, of course, I'm 100% Bernie. That's obvious and transparent. And it isn't just foreign. There's, I mean, domestic, the case he's making.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, it seemed to me like, you know, on domestic stuff, what Warren is putting forward, other than this very weird equivocations on Medicare for All, she's putting together, in some cases, you know, proposals that are the best of the Democratic field. Her foreign policy, particularly the way she's, you know, pretty horrible on Israel stuff. Bernie was certainly the first person willing to at least even voice actual support, ironically, for what is official U.S. policy in terms of opposing occupation or even just acknowledging basic Palestinian humanity. You know, Elizabeth Warren was right there with a Kamala Harris a couple years ago, and not even with a Beto O'Rourke, and it just kind of being like, whoa, like we're supposed to be 2019 Democrats. We can't exactly embrace, like, you know, an overt bigot like Netanyahu. But do you think, I guess that's like a preamble of like, what is she getting anything right in foreign policy? Like, what is she bringing to the table in foreign policy that's distinct in a good way or none?
I mean, she hasn't been particularly elaborated on this, but from my sense, I think Elizabeth Warren would be very good at sort of reconstructing the global financial architecture to be less welcoming to basically American multinational corporations who flee so many taxes in various tax havens, particularly in the Caribbean. That's what I think Elizabeth Warren would be best at, essentially her global economic policy. But my sense from all that I've read about her security and diplomatic policy, it's basically Cold War retreads in a very serious way, where she would, I think, promote a lot of the sort of interventionist policies that have defined Democratic foreign policy really since Lyndon Johnson decided to escalate the war in Vietnam in 1964-65. So she's been, to me, a big disappointment on foreign policy, even though I think, like you said, she has been way ahead, ironically, or somewhat sadly, of many of the Democratic candidates in terms of advancing like particular technical policy solutions. Now, the question about the particular technical policy solutions, at least the question that I have, is that maybe this isn't the moment for the type of Brandeisian anti-monopoly politics of Elizabeth Warren, which essentially, as I view it, tries to save capitalism from itself. Right. But it might be actually the moment for Bernie Sanders, who just fundamentally rejects a lot of the institutions and doesn't think that necessarily that they could be made better, but needs to be replaced. But they need to be replaced by new types of institutions that are more skeptical of fundamental capitalism. So this is, I think, this sort of rub with you know, it's good that she has these proposals. But is that necessarily what we want in the next president?
No, I mean, of course, I 100% agree with you. I was just curious to find, you know, yeah, we're on the same page. But I do think, you know, in foreign policy, in domestic policy, a lot of proposals are really good and intellectually demanding and really important.
Sure.
And in foreign policy, it just, I don't see, like, I read her, you know, her fans were, you need to read her foreign affairs essay. And it was like, right, I think that's correct. I think in the areas that we already know she's really good on, she definitely has a sense of things like the Panama paper foreign policy, right? Like, and
exactly.
That's hugely important, but I agree with you. I don't think there's any evidence that on a whole slew of basic, you know, hierarchical relationships built on faulty assumptions, let alone sort of horizon issues of, you know, not indulging in, you know, dangerous policy towards China as an example, or, you know, rethinking how we deal with Africa. I just don't see it. But in Bernie, there's a funny contradiction that I see too, because I think on one hand, I mean, if you look at his career in the 80s, he had very much like he was a lefty. You know, he was here's a Vermont shout out, even though he wasn't from there, but he is a Brattleboro food co-op foreign policy, right? Like, this guy is,
absolutely,
you know, he's handing out the flyers. He wants to do, you know, he's talking about how Reagan's backing all of these, you know, murderous regimes across Latin and Central America. I'm sure that his feelings on Israel were much more complicated because, you know, I just give a generational pass. That being said, he endorsed Jesse Jackson. He noted there's videos of him in the 80s saying the Palestinians need rights. That actually puts him well to the left of the dial. And then he gets into Congress. And again, I think, again, we got to credit where credit is due. I mean, the basic dividing line. He opposed the invasion of Iraq. That still is the most important, you know, macro foreign policy decision the last couple of decades. And he was 100% right on it. You know, and then I think in other areas, it was a combination of, you know, his priorities really were domestic. That's also probably where he felt he could do some things. And I think in 2016, it was almost like he got reawakened, because I think that he kind of just put his head down and even sometimes went along with and voted for some very bad foreign policy ideas. And then in 2016, he kind of started with like, well, hey, you know, I'm not a fan of Kissinger because I sort of like don't like war criminals. How about that? And then people were like, hey, that's great. What else you got? And he's like, well, you know, while we're at it, I don't think Palestinians are subhuman and should get hit with white phosphorus every other day. And people are like, you know what? Sounds pretty good, man. What else you got? And then, you know, in preparation for running for president, he brought on Matt Duss and so on. And he's been trying to synthesize. And I think, you know, again, there is a global authoritarian axis, but that's, you know, that's also the kind of outreach to a sort of liberal view. But at the same time, in the same speech where he's talking about Bolsonaro, and obviously this would be something I would notice, he's certainly the only presidential candidate who recognizes, like, you know, in the phrase, you know, Lula's in jail under very questionable circumstances. Whereas I think, you know, even just brand-wise, is Elizabeth Warren going to take on the process of being like, oh, well, there's sometimes just like fake nonsense corruption investigations that are political projects, not legal ones, and they're really dangerous. And it, you know, belies a certain deeper skepticism. So I think that you're writing to both sides of Bernie's nature here. And, you know, what's your sense of the team around him, of what way it breaks? And if it breaks the good way, is America ready for that? Like a real just kind of more fundamental sort of, you know, not anti-American, not, you know, not a guy who's giving just, you know, like anti-foreign policy diatribes in the White House, but somebody who's really like fundamentally is about diplomacy. And also I really acknowledge, just as a practical matter, the ways in which the United States is a major problem in world affairs. And I want to de-escalate those problems because ultimately they aren't beneficial to the American people.
I think those are great questions. So I think fundamentally I trust Bernie. I think he has good instincts. And I particularly, as you alluded to, trust people like Matt Duss who are around him, who have been really thinking about these issues for decades. And I have no doubt have basically agree with everything that we said. If I had to guess, I would say Matt Duss agrees with everything that we just said, and that Bernie could very quickly be convinced of it. And if he did sort of reaffirm these types of Cold War frameworks, it's probably just because more out of habit than any deep conviction to fighting existential wars with these various global authoritarian axes. I think he was what I think ultimately is that he was trying to draw attention to what is truly a global problem, particularly as it relates to his major issue, which is a domestic inequality, and how things like tax havens and kleptocracy abroad do affect American domestic politics at home. So I have no reticence whatsoever about supporting Bernie 110%, because I trust the man. I think his instincts have long been correct. Foreign policy was not his major focus, but I think he could very clearly be convinced. And again, that's demonstrated by the team that he's hired, and the team that he's recently hired to run his campaign are people who basically agree with everything we just said. So I think Bernie, if elected, would be great on this. Now, the question, I think, of American receptivity to this is an interesting one and a difficult one. And I want to basically break it down into two issues. So on one hand, I think Americans are ready to reconceive of the United States' world role, because unlike, let's say, in the period between 1945 and 1975, the majority of Americans do not benefit from the United States' prime position, right? They do not, the wages have stagnated, inequality has increased, and despite the fact that the United States has 800 bases abroad, the empire doesn't really do much to help them. So I think that in that sense, there's a material reality that Americans are like, what is this globe-spanning system of 800 bases, all of these aircraft carriers, all of these commands that essentially control the entire world? What is that doing for me? And particularly the fact that so much of our domestic resources, so many of our domestic resources are diverted to the military, with Trump asking for about $750 billion in military aid going forward, which is literally absurd in the world where the United States faces no peer competitors and basically no global challenges. Only the problems of international relations, particularly climate change and nuclear weapons, which to me are the one and two most important problems that we're facing, are basically problems that can only be solved through diplomacy, and the military could literally do nothing about them. And therefore, we should basically ramp down our military budget dramatically. I would say, like, get rid of $600 billion of it. Most people won't agree with that one, but at least we should get rid of a significant hundreds of billions. Well, I know you would, but significant hundreds of billions. And
but I'm the type of guy that thinks Henry Kissinger's a war criminal. So, you know, what do I know?
Exactly.
Right.
What do you know?
Right.
So basically refund the State Department. But the other problem is, and I think this is important, particularly, honestly, Michael, shows like this, I think, are really crucial in this effort. There is a cultural militarism in the United States that really began taking off in the 1940s and is now just absurd. The fact that military bands play at football games, the fact that all these military aircraft are always flown over football games and things like that, and various other sporting events, the fact that all of our video games are about basically fighting good wars, the incredible militaristic violence in American society is, I think, a major obstacle to having Americans rethink the role of the military in American society. And I think the question is, particularly for the left, particularly for, you know, cultural figures like yourself and shows like the Majority Report and the Michael Brooks Show, is what can they do to basically attenuate this cultural militarism, which is really informed and I would say infected many of the ways in which American rules the world. So you have the material reality where the military and the global basing system is not really benefiting the ordinary Americans, but you have the cultural reality where the military is basically the most valorized institution in American life. And this is actually a really difficult and complex situation. And so I think that's going to be a major issue going forward if people like Bernie, and I think he does, if people like Bernie want to reframe and rethink how the United States interacts abroad.
Final question. I just want to touch on China for a minute. Do you think it's possible that and I'm setting a lot because even like what China's doing in Africa is actually, you know, I just want to note, is an incredible process of sort of aggressive neo-imperialism. Belt and Road is very mixed and might yield some good things, but it's also, again, it's very environmentally damaging. And, you know, I hate this idea of like a three-party proxy war in Africa between primarily the United States and China, but also like France trying to protect its basically uninterrupted colonial relationships there is very disturbing, and you know, we'll talk about that more. But do you think it's possible to reorient the G2 China US relationship on basically like plenty of disputes and things to work out and so on, but we need to have a sort of global partnership on climate and a broader global environmental policy, which for all of their problems, you know, China does appear to at least on a policy level take somewhat seriously. And if we had someone in the White House who wasn't, you know, just an insane sort of patron of oil interests, or in fact, even like a Democrat that accepted the science, but still is essentially just in the pocket of oil and gas industry, but somebody who actually comes in there and says, no, I get that this is the number one global emergency we face. Could that be the basis of a kind of productive partnership amidst other conflicts?
Yeah, and I think that's a really important question. So the way that I view it is, in 50 years, the United States will almost certainly not be in the Eastern Hemisphere in the way that it has been, right? So now, a lot of people disagree with that. Some people really are committed to maintaining the U.S. presence in the Eastern Hemisphere, in the South China Sea, in East Asia, et cetera. But if one believes, as I do, that the United States, that China is basically simply too big, simply too powerful, and simply too interested in maintaining dominance of its region, just like the United States has for centuries, in the very bad ways, I might add, maintained dominance of the Western Hemisphere, I don't think it's fair to think that the United States will still be in East Asia in the way that it has been for decades at this point. So to my issue, to my view, rather, the way to foster Chinese-U.S. cooperation, which I agree is absolutely central to basically fighting climate change, most importantly, but also, you know, contributing to nuclear demilitarization, et cetera, mm-hmm. The way to do that is for the United States to recognize that it needs to start drawing down in East Asia and what that means for our allies, right? What is it going to mean for Japan, South Korea, and the other nations?
And Taiwan. I worry for Taiwan.
Yep.
I worry for Taiwan a lot.
It's really difficult. It's really difficult because I don't think the United States is going to fight World War III over any of those countries. Right. So the issue is, how do you basically negotiate some sort of security transition in East Asia that enables places like Japan and South Korea and Taiwan to maintain some sort of sovereign independence in the face of an enormous China, while also not antagonizing China needlessly, particularly when we need to cooperate with them over with issues like climate change? So I think this is basically the great question of the next 25 to 50 years of American diplomacy. How could you essentially do that? And basically, do you do that in a way that where you have a type of ring of containment from Japan to Taiwan to Australia, one might add, that tries to quote unquote contain China? Or do you develop some sort of true global architecture where there are basically accepted spheres of influence for particular countries. And I might add, these are all imperfect solutions, but in an imperfect, tragic world of international relations, I think you're choosing really between imperfect solutions. And the way to foster peace and the way to combat climate change is for the United States to recognize that it's not going to be able to have the influence that it has long had in East Asia and to begin a process of drawing down in the region that at the same time doesn't just totally abandon our allies to the Chinese rise.
Perfect. I just want to spitball an idea. I'm wondering if we could organize a debate between you and Samantha Power, but here's the twist. It's moderated by Sebastian Gorka, and he calls both of you cucks.
That is extremely hot.
Daniel Bessner, I appreciate your time as always. The Peace in the Nation, Foreign Policy Beyond Good and Evil, co-authored with Udi Greenberg. Read it. It's a great piece. Read everything Daniel does, particularly Hans Speier, The Rise of the Defense Intellectuals. I mean, that book is actually, like, if you're just really even interested in just a kind of filter of understanding, like, post-World War II America, it's a well-written, great history. Daniel, thanks a million as always. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Michael. Have a good one.
You too. Thanks, man. All right, folks, become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. Less than a cup of coffee a day. Go to justcoffee.coop, get your fair trade tea, coffee, or chocolate. That's such an awesome company. Subscribe, spread the word, like, review, all of that good stuff. Do the same thing with the Michael Brooks Show. Become a patron at patreon.com/tmbs/show. We had on Francesca Ferrantini to talk about AIPAC, Matt Saibi to talk about the media failure of Russiagate. And on this Sunday, an illicit history of redlining and a case for reparations with Marissa Barrara-Darn. Patreon.com/TMBS and all sorts of clips at Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. Matt.
Literary Hangover. Next episode's going to be the first Saturday in the next month, but the King Philip's War episode is still up there. If you're not subscribed on YouTube, subscribe, because that is going to get monetized soon, and I might start doing some more stuff on that, like actual video stuff, but we'll see.
It's a good idea.
Also check out Antifada. We have a new, you've heard the song before, but now Bullprog has done
Bullprog is quite talented.
Yeah, very all around media producer.
This is a Bullprog. Talented person. Check this out. See you in the fun half.
Left is best. Thank you for calling into the Majority Report.